Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of February. Felony disenfranchisement laws deny almost 6 million Americans the right to vote. Attorney General Eric Holder gave a speech last week at Georgetown University Law Center and said it is time to fundamentally rethink laws that permanently disenfranchise people who are no longer under federal or state supervision. He asked that people who can't vote due to past felony convictions have their voting rights restored. The remarks were made at an event sponsored by the Leadership Conference Education Fund, and it was a bipartisan event examining ongoing criminal justice reform. This hour of the program, we'll talk about this issue and also look more broadly at the issue of voting rights. Brenton Mock is our guest, Washington, D.C.-based journalist who serves as a reporting fellow for ColorLines.com, where he covers national politics. He's also a contributor for the blog Policy Shop, where he covers voting rights and civil rights, and he writes about environmental justice as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest, Brenton. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, where we've already had several comments, and we will get to them on the air, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Brenton, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, glad to be on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, our pleasure to have you here. So was this address given by the Attorney General somewhat a surprise, or has he been hinting at these kinds of thoughts the whole time he's been Attorney General?
The people who I've spoken with, who have covered this issue pretty regularly, like the folks at the Sentencing Project, at the Leadership Committee on Civil and Human Rights, many of them told me that they were not anticipating him to make that those comments last week, that it was somewhat of a surprise. Mm. That said, what he announced was part of a larger list of criminal justice reforms that would address not only the over-incarceration crisis that we have in America, but the larger over-criminalization of African Americans that feeds that system, and felony disenfranchisement fits right into that.
Can you give us a little bit of a history of felony disenfranchisement? Does it go back to Reconstruction after the Civil War?
Well, it goes back before that. If we want to be honest, my friends over at the Wall Street Journal made this point that felony disenfranchisement laws go all the way back to Europe, early 18th century in Europe, and especially in Rome and Greece. But the big difference is once it got to America, while it's true that there were felony disenfranchisement laws that existed before the Civil War, as Eric Holder pointed out last week, the fact is that after the Civil War, when African Americans were emancipated and we had freed slaves, a lot of those laws, a lot of the states in the Deep South, the slaveholding states, when during their constitutional conventions, a lot of them while redrafting their constitutions, they elected to keep certain laws on the books that would further, that would keep the newly freed slaves from attaining any kind of political power. And so the felony disenfranchisement laws were one of those laws that were preserved. And not only were they preserved, but a lot of them were strengthened, right? They were made even more strict, specifically with the purposes of making sure that black people wouldn't be able to vote. I mean, and we saw this in Florida during the 1868 Constitutional Convention, where legislators were very specific. They said that part of the reason why they wanted to keep felony disenfranchisement laws on the books was they wanted to prevent a Negro legislature. And so, for whatever its origins in Rome and Greece or in Europe, back in ancient times, it certainly has not kept up with the present, where now the United States is the only industrialized nation that still continues to disenfranchise those with felony convictions.
Mm-hmm. So how are these decisions made? My understanding is that there are still quite a few states in the South that disenfranchise predominantly communities of color are disproportionately affected here. But it is a state-by-state decision. You can decide whether or not you can vote if you're a felon. If you're in prison, a couple states allow that. Some, you have to go to the governor and petition the governor once you're out of prison. It's all decided by the states?
Yes. Due to the U.S. Constitution, unfortunately, there is an amendment in the U.S. Constitution that seems to provide for, legal felony disenfranchisement and leaving that up to states to determine that. And right now what we have are 11 states that prohibit both, the incarcerated, those on parole and probation, and those who are ex-felons from participating in the election process. And in at least four of those states, Virginia, Florida, Iowa, and Kentucky, the ban on ex-felon voting is so strict that you might as well say it's a permanent ban. I mean, in all of these cases, you basically have to appeal to the governor personally, and after a long waiting period and after paying a number of fines in order to even be considered for having your voting rights restored. And so, many of the states that have those laws still on the books are throughout the South.
And what about the two states that allow felons to vote from prison? How did they reach that decision?
That's a good question. I mean, that's Maine and Vermont. My speculation would be that, Maine and Vermont also have, they have some of the lowest populations for people of color. It's worth speculating whether if they had as large of a black population as, say, somewhere like Florida or New York, if they would, still allow inmates to vote from prison. But as far as I'm concerned, every state should have those kinds of laws. I mean, you're still serving in a particular place, and you're being governed, by county or city or state government, and you should have some say over the rules that govern your life, whether incarcerated or not.
So the Attorney General, it's my understanding, really doesn't have any direct authority to change these state laws. So why were those words important? What effect could they have?
I think what it is he's basically been, or Eric Holder, Attorney General Eric Holder, has basically been coming to grips with the limitations of federal power, and that's how it was put to me by Sherrilyn Ifill when I interviewed her yesterday. The president of NAACP LDF, she met with Eric Holder and Obama yesterday. Mm. And she basically, her interpretation of all of this is that basically the Obama administration is doing what they can to use their federal powers as a bully pulpit to hopefully bring states into alignment with how the federal government is going about their own business. And so with the federal government, with Eric Holder and the Department of Justice calling for the relaxation of mandatory minimum sentences, especially for nonviolent felon offenses, they would hope that the state would come along and do the same thing. And I think it's the same pattern with felony disenfranchisement. But unfortunately, the Constitution does make this a state, the providence of the states. There are some lawyers who believe that that the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, which bans any kind of discrimination against people of color or any practice that would dilute the voting power of communities of color, that those would be a violation of the federal law. But unfortunately, a lot of the cases that have tried to bring those kinds of suits have failed. There was one in Washington, there was one in Alabama, one in Florida. They just haven't had a lot of success applying the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act to this issue.
Britton, I was interested, and you probably know more about this study and those who are opposed to the extension of voting to those who are felons to make it easier here have said that this study has flaws. But I believe even the attorney general cited a Florida study that had been done showing there's a direct relationship between the right to vote and whether or not you're going to commit a crime again.
Yeah, most. I mean, there's a lot of research about this, and we have to remember above all that giving those formerly convicted of felons the right to vote is not just good for a fair and equal democracy, but it's also a good public safety issue, right? Because a lot of people, when they come out of prison, they need all of the avenues available to be able to rejoin society and be able to participate in democracy. And when you block or obstruct those avenues, then what else choice do they have except for to resort back to the kinds of activities that landed them in jail to begin with? And it doesn't just affect those who have made mistakes or who have committed crimes. It also, there's a ripple effect on the communities. There's a great professor named Tracy Birch out of Northwestern University who wrote a book called Trading Democracy for Justice, and she talks about how the neighborhoods where there are high imprisonment levels, those correspond with significant decreases in political participation, meaning those communities where there are a lot of people incarcerated happen to be the same communities where there's low voter turnout or low voter registration. And basically, it's because, democracy is impacted when members of your society, are locked away and you're not able to share amongst each other, the values that and the various issues that that you would like to vote, go to the polls about, such as stand your ground or stop and frisk or any issues that might be impacting the low communities of color or low income communities. So there's research all around that shows how this really impacts not just people in prison, but the people from those communities.
I'm wondering if there are partisan politics, alas, that those would rear their ugly head here. But I wonder if there are partisan politics involved here. We heard a great deal about that highly contentious presidential vote in 2000 in Florida. The president, George W. Bush, won by 537 votes, but there were more than 800,000 citizens of Florida with criminal records who could not vote in that election. Is there a concern that these voters will vote Democratic and thus, Florida doesn't want to change the law? Are politics at play here?
Well, yes and no. I want to, historically, we know that conservatives and Republicans, at least, the current version of the Republican Party of the last few decades, we know that they have been, very clear about strategies where they could literally pick who votes, right? Like, they don't want an expanded electorate. They want a very small electorate where only certain people can vote. And we've heard many comments from Republicans and conservatives, who've publicly stated that, people who are too lazy or who don't know how to comport with the law, how they don't, quote unquote, deserve to vote, right? And so that's why there's been a lot of conservative support for felony disenfranchisement laws, or at least that's why it's been so difficult to get rid of them. On the flip end, though, just to bring it to the current day, you have a huge proponent for getting rid of felony disenfranchisement laws in Senator Rand Paul,
yes,
out of Kentucky, as it were. Paul seems to be sincere. I mean, at least in terms of the general relaxing the laws that lead to over-incarceration. And he's even, testified that, the racial disparities and the felony disenfranchisement that comes from the war on drugs is a disgusting thing that needs to be addressed. As for whether he has a huge following behind him amongst his colleagues in Congress, that's a whole other issue. But Rand Paul has been, he's been coming around on this. He had lunch with Eric Holder the day after Eric Holder made those comments about ending felony disenfranchisement, and we've not seen any signs that Paul is backing away from any of this since Holder made those comments. So, it's interesting. I mean, the place where Holder made those comments, there were members from the Heritage Foundation, American Enterprise Institute. I mean, it wasn't a partisan place. You know, it was definitely a bipartisan gathering. So it seems like that conservatives are coming around on this.
Mm-hmm. And before we go to phone calls, when you look, and maybe this is different from state by state, when you are disenfranchised, does it mean you're not eligible for voting in any kind of race, local, state, or federal, or is it just federal? In some states, can you vote for a federal election? What's the story, not all 50 states, but generally, what's the story here?
Yeah, it is. You know, every state has their own customized laws around, who among those with felony convictions can vote. that said, we have to look at the fact that it's not in some of the worst places, it's not only your vote that's taken away, but you're barred from being able to contract with the government, right? You're barred from being able to serve on juries. In many cases, you're barred from being able to get public benefits such as housing, student loans. Desmond Meade, who's one of the heads of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, which is focusing on this issue, he himself is a former has a felony conviction on his record, and he can take you through a whole list of things in Florida that you're barred from doing. If you have one of these convictions, it essentially erases you from society.
Mm. We welcome phone calls, and here's how you can reach our conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The question of the hour is whether or not former prisoners with felony convictions ought to be able to be given the right to vote, why they are disenfranchised in 11 states, and there are restrictions in other states as well. What kind of law would you write here if you could write a federal law, if you had the power of, well, it's all up to the states, but if you were governor of one state or another, what do you think would be fair? Should those who are convicted of felonies who are in prison be allowed to vote? That's one extreme. Or should you lose if you are convicted, even if you've served your time and your parole, should you forever lose your chance to vote? We have one line open, so take it. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Brenton Mock. He's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist, serves as reporting fellow for ColorLines.com, where he covers national politics. He also writes for a number of other publications, American Prospect, The Washington Post, The Root, In These Times, etc. To your calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest this hour is Brenton Mock. We are talking about what the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder called for last week. That's restoring felons their right to vote. We're looking at what's happening state by state and getting your thoughts on this as well. 800-486-8655 is our number. Jay in Pewaukee is our first caller. Hi, Jay.
Hi. Just doing a quick Google search about voting laws brought up for me, procon.org, that I think I heard you point out that only 11 states out of the 50 you might permanently lose your voting privileges. And there's different details, regarding that you might be able to vote. So, I mean, the other 39, after you serve your time, probation and all that, you're able to get your right back to vote. So, I mean, if you choose to commit a felony, the right to vote must not have been that important to you to begin with. So I don't see any need for changing the law.
Brenton, your response.
Yeah, I mean, who amongst us hasn't made a mistake, here in America? You know, often the difference between those who've made mistakes who are in prison right now and those who have made mistakes and who are not in prison normally comes down to, cases around money and economics, whether you could afford a good lawyer. You know, and so I don't think anybody who makes such mistakes, you know, goes into it saying, you know what, this is, you know, this is going to cost me my vote, but, you know, I'm going to do this anyway. I mean, I don't think that that's on anyone's mind, you know, when they're doing a lot of things, you know, and so regardless, it doesn't, any of that, regardless of what mistake you've made, I don't, you know, once you have served your time, whether through incarceration or whether through parole or probation, I mean, you've paid your debt to society, and there's no real legal, moral, or ethical reason, or let alone democratic reason, for continuing to punish a person in perpetuity, you know, basically because they made a mistake in the past. I mean, and we have to look at the racial disparities here, right? You know, often the difference between those who are in prison and who are not has to do with race, right, because of the racism that's baked into the criminal justice system. So, you know, the disenfranchising factor here helps to perpetuate not only economic inequalities, but racial inequalities. And that's the kind of thing that we need to keep front and present.
We've had a lot of Facebook comments. Let me read a couple of them to you. This one from Richard. Good move in general. With one stipulation, those who are incarcerated for violent crimes must first successfully complete their parole. What do you think of that, Brenton?
I'm sorry, could you repeat it one more time?
Oh, I'm sorry. Good move in general. With one stipulation, those who are incarcerated for violent crimes must first successfully complete their parole.
What state is that for?
Oh, that's just a comment on Facebook for you from Richard.
Oh,
I just
okay.
A general statement.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, again, there's, you know, states have all different kinds of parameters for how to restore voting rights. That person may be referring to Virginia, where Virginia used to be one of the four that had the states that had the strictest bans on voting for former felons. But under the former governor, Bob McDonnell, he began relaxing those restrictions so that people who have been convicted of nonviolent felonies could more easily have their voting rights restored. Those who have been convicted of violent felonies still have a very arduous process ahead of them if they like to have their voting rights restored. It's better than what it was before, you know, under previous Virginia regimes where, you know, both those convicted of nonviolent and violent felonies had to wait upwards of 5 to 7 years just to be able to apply for voting rights restoration.
Michael is next in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to, I tuned in a little late, so I may be repeating what's been said, but the United States, having only 4% of the population, has over 25% of the world's prison inmates, jail, prison, probation, parole. And that disparity is crazy in the sense that we incarcerate so many people, and then to take away their vote, which is the most fundamental right of a person in the United States or anybody in the world, is the most fundamental thing that we could have. It's just ridiculous to take away a person's vote after they've served their time and did their probation or parole.
Brenton.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, this is personal for me. I mean, I have friends and family members who've been incarcerated, a lot of colleagues as well. And, you know, one thing that is very true about, you know, many people who go into the prison system, you know, there are law libraries in there, right? And a lot of men and a lot of women go into prison and they take advantage of those law libraries. They're learning about laws that they probably didn't even know existed when, you know, before they went in. And they're finding, the beautiful thing about that is they're finding out more about democracy. They're finding out more about, you know, what it means to be a member of society. And a lot of them come out armed with certificates and licenses and even diplomas in these issues of civic society. And then they come out into society, and suddenly they can't even use the very things that they spend a lot of time in prison learning about, because they can't vote, because they can't serve on jury duty, because they can't run for office, which is another disenfranchising element in certain states. So, you know, the people who are in prison, we don't know who could be the next, or who could have been the next Barack Obama, the next Eric Holder, the next Bill de Blasio, you know, any of these politicians. I mean, you have some very sharp, intelligent people in there who, you know, for all intents, you know, made mistakes. To take away their vote, again, is just an erasure of democracy in this nation.
It really indicates that what justice is, we don't have a common definition in this country of what justice is. It varies from state to state. And I fail to understand why a good case couldn't be made federally for deciding as a nation what we're going to do in this regard, because it is a fundamental American right, and justice is something that we all have. We should be able to come up with a common definition of that, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I mean, justice means a lot of things to a lot of people. One of my other beats that I cover is environmental justice, and it's always mind-boggling to me when commenters come, you know, onto my blog and they're giving me all of these different definitions of what environmental justice means, and you know, a lot of them they're a wild stretch away from what the original people who created environmental justice intended. And it's the same with this situation here. You know, justice means different things depending on what your ideology is, where you grew up, what your own values are religiously, racially, culturally. But one thing that we should all be able to agree upon is that everyone should be able to access their ballot in a fair and free manner. Right, we should all have equal access to the ballot. If we're going to start putting up restrictions and obstructions for why one group of people can't vote, then, you know, following with that logic, then people can come up with a whole other set of rules for why we can't vote tomorrow. And then where it'll end. You know, the arc of justice in general in America has bended towards expanding the electorate since this nation has started, not restricting it. But we have a lot of conservatives who are kind of hell-bent on bending that arc the opposite way.
I'm having a hard time understanding. If you can vote and you're a felon in prison in Maine or Vermont, and you've served your time and you're out of prison and you can't vote in Mississippi, how does the Voting Rights Act not cover what would clearly be, at least on face value, on first reading of this, a form of discrimination against those people of color who are disproportionately affected?
I think those are good questions. When you look at Eric Holder's remarks at the Georgetown Criminal Justice Forum last week, he used very specific legal terms that comport with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, right? Like he very clearly said that felony disenfranchisement laws lead to racial disparate impacts, right, on communities of color. He very clearly said that such laws dilute the minority voting power. And, you know, anytime you're talking about disparate impacts, Civil Rights Act has laws for that, like Title VI. I mean, and when you talk about dilution of minority voting rights, I mean, the Voting Rights Act, you know, Section 2 specifically deals directly with that. And so a lot of people are scratching their heads about why this hasn't been something that you could just kind of deal with in a federal court. There have been cases where there were attempts made, both in the South and outside of the South. Out in Washington, there was a case where called Farrakhan versus Gregoire, where it made it all the way up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is, you know, by and large regarded as the most liberal circuit court, federal court in America. But they were not able to have a successful challenge of felony disenfranchisement laws on civil rights, on Voting Rights Act grounds. There was another case, City of Mobile versus Bolden, which was about Alabama, and which was very specifically about the racist intentions of the state legislature in the early 19th century when they created this law. They dredged up that history where legislators specifically said, we don't want black people, voting.
Uh-huh.
But they weren't able to get a successful ruling on that as well. Hmm. So it's been tough.
Yeah. Jude in Ellison Bay. Hi.
I don't have any statistics to back this up, but I've made an observation over the last couple of decades that crimes that might have been misdemeanors historically have been up to felonies, and I think it's to make the charge stick. And if a person can't afford to have an attorney that's helping bargain those things down, the felony goes on. And that's just my observation.
All right, you want to respond, Britton?
Yeah, I mean, one of the tricks that legislatures played was they made the kind of crimes that disqualified a person from voting. A lot of states expanded that list of disqualifying crimes, right, during the Reconstruction era. So crimes that were misdemeanors or summaries, all of a sudden they became felonies. And a lot of this happened to fall along racial lines for whatever reason. This definitely happened in Florida. It happened in Virginia. Getting back to the bipartisan discussion we were having earlier, to his credit, the former Attorney General of Virginia, whose name is escaping me right now, but this is a guy who was conservative as all hell, but he, you know, to his credit, he stood up and testified for getting rid of felony disenfranchisement laws to a certain degree, and basically stated that certain laws that constitute felonies in Virginia really should be misdemeanors because, you know, they just don't rise to the level of the kind of obscenity that would normally make it a felony. You know, one of the laws that will disqualify, that counts as a felony and would disqualify you from voting in both Virginia and Florida, I believe, is bouncing a check.
Really? Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Huh.
So well, trying to understand how, like, a person, like a single mother who might have bounced a check so that she could buy extra formula for her kids, now she has a felony on her record and can't vote. I mean, these are the kinds of people who are impacted by
mm-hmm. it. Well, and to say nothing of all the people who are in prison because of nonviolent drug-related charges.
Right. And people who are in prison for nonviolent drug-related charges is a highly racialized
yes.
thing, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, we're talking about people who've made mistakes. We're also talking about people who have had to make unwise decisions based off of their economic and racial predicament in America, and now they're being further punished for it.
Valerie in Grafton, hi.
Hi. I recently read a book. It's called The New Jim Crow, and it talks a lot about this subject, about the war on drugs and how it disproportionately affects racial minorities and then leads to them not being able to exercise voting privileges and other things. I was just wondering if the guest had put it and what his opinions on the book were.
The New Jim Crow was an eye-opener for me, both in reading it and also from hearing directly from Michelle Alexander at a number of lectures as she talked about it. As she talked about it not just from an academic point of view, but how it affected her personally, affected people who she represented as a lawyer personally, how it affected the communities of that hosted the people that she served as, you know, who served as her client personally. I mean, there are real human impacts that come along with felony disenfranchisement that we need to consider. It's not just numbers on a page. These are the kinds of laws that really reduce not only the political participation of communities, but it really dampens the spirits of people, right? I mean, people who see an injustice in something like Stand Your Ground and Stop and Frisk, and they really want to go out and do something about it, but then they look around and all they see are these disenfranchising elements, and it really has a suppressive impact on them, a chilling impact on communities as a whole. I mean, there's nothing that says voter suppression more than felony disenfranchisement.
Thanks, Valerie, for the call. Let's go to Mike in Wauwatosa. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I wanted to comment that, the issue that you're going at, although it is dealing with the way disenfranchisement affects their political life, I mean, the reality is that if you'd have gone back 100, 150 years, at that point in time, there were maybe 40 to 50, you know, crimes that would have been defined as felonious crimes, whereas now you're in any typical state, you're looking at more like, you know, 800 to 1,000 crimes that would be defined as felonious crimes, largely due to the fact that we have a changing economic picture in this country. And the economic picture that we've got now incorporates groups that would not previously part of that economic life. Women, people of color, other minorities, and that because we have made addresses that we've made with respect to involving a greater and greater portion of our population in our economic life, those people that have become less affected, or less effective, rather, in the economic world, basically white men, of which I'm one, that this is a way of attacking that involvement. And the reason I say that is that the economic success of an individual in this type of an open society depends upon their involvement in all aspects of the society. So if you eliminate them from a very significant part, namely political participation, civic participation, you've eliminated them from an enormous economic part as well.
Brenton.
Yeah. No, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I can't emphasize this enough. The people who are serving in prison right now, they could be, you know, the future principals who are turning around the education system. They could be the people who are solving, you know, coming up with cures for cancer, cures for AIDS. Removing them from society, both in a political way and an economic way, it does a disservice to society in general, not just to that person who was in jail. When we realize as a society how we lose, how we are that much less democratic, how we are that much less fair, how we are that much more invested in inequality because we have felony disenfranchisement laws on the grounds, at that moment is the point where, you know, I think people would really start to call for the complete eradication of these laws.
In those 11 states where they still exist, is there a big hullabaloo about changing them, Brenton, or are people kind of going along with the flow? Well, this is just the way it is.
Well, I mean, like I said, in Virginia, they're making a lot of progress. Bob McDonnell, the former governor, he began relaxing, you know, the disenfranchising laws for nonviolent felons. The current governor, Terry McAuliffe, is expected to take it even further, hopefully an automatic restoration of rights for all felons, violent and nonviolent.
Mm-hmm. So this is up to governors, or does that vary from state to state? Brenton? Oh, he's gone. Well, we need to pause for a moment anyhow. Don't worry, we will find him. We're talking this hour about responding to Attorney General Eric Holder's speech last week, in which he said that it is time to fundamentally rethink laws that permanently disenfranchise people who are no longer under federal or state supervision. There are 11 states that bar people with felony convictions from voting, even after they've completed probation or parole. In some, you forever relinquish the right to vote. So that's what's on our table this hour. Brenton Mock is our guest, Washington, D.C.-based journalist. He's a reporting fellow for ColorLines.com, where he covers national politics, also blogs for a number of other places, and previously served as lead reporter for Voting Rights Watch 2012, which was a joint effort between Color Lines and The Nation magazine. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open right now, and the number to reach us is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where you can leave your thoughts, and we may get to some of them on the air. And you can also find us at Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls and emails for our guest, Brenton Mock. And let's go to Don in Madison next. Hi, Don.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say, first off, I'm a retired federal law enforcement officer, having worked drug cases for many years. And I wanted to say that the position taken by your guest, in some cases goes too far, and in other cases goes not far enough.
Hmm.
After having read the book, The New Jim Crow, and having it kind of ball-peen hammer in my forehead how much of complicity I had in that action, the racial disparity that your guest was talking about is clearly right on target. But I also want to say that I encountered people throughout my career that there's no way would I ever want them to have the right to vote, or no way would I ever want them to have the right to work around kids. That having been said, in the cases of a lack of violence in the felony conviction, just voter rights does not go far enough. Most job applications, if you're applying for a job, you're asked whether or not you've ever been convicted of a crime. And my argument would be that in many cases, if you check that you've been convicted of a felony on this application, that you're automatically going to be passed over for that particular job. So I'm all for rehabilitation and reenfranchisement of people who committed nonviolent crimes, but there are those there in drawing a distinction here, and I know the slippery slope that you go down, but there should also be a distinction between those violent offenders who have abdicated the right to engage in normal societal functions. Mm-hmm. And I'll hang up and listen.
John, don't go yet. Are you still there?
Okay.
Okay.
Yes,
I'm just wondering what you think if you've committed a violent offense. You should lose the right to vote? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, I think a felony conviction in that kind of sense does preclude you from participating in some extent the affairs of society because the argument that I'm hearing on this program is that once you've served your debt to society, then all those considerations should be taken off. Well, the violent crime that was committed, it never goes away for the victim. The victim is always victimized by the crime, is always disenfranchised by the actions of the perpetrator in committing that felony against them. So, on the one hand, we talk about we want to enfranchise people who have committed nonviolent drug offenses or whatever. But at the same time, let's not forget about the victims who have been traumatized and have completely had their lives turned around by their encounter with this violent offender.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much, Don, for your call. Brenton, what about that?
Yeah, well, I respect his opinion as a law enforcement officer, but I would pose the question back to him. Should George Zimmerman be able to vote? I mean, he wasn't convicted, but he damn sure did kill somebody. He committed the highest count of violence. You know, so should he be able to vote? Do the parents of Trayvon Martin have a say about whether the killer of their son should be able to be reenfranchised just because basically based off of whether he was actually convicted or not? I mean, it's very hard for me to understand how anyone can read the new Jim Crow, understand and accept the racial disparities, but still make a case for why we should disenfranchise certain people based off of the classification of violent versus nonviolent. I mean, let's go a step further. Let's define violent, right? Like what Bernie Madoff did with money, you know, with all of these banks did to almost bankrupt America. Was that not violence done to society? There was some violence that were done to many people's savings and IRA and retirement accounts, and those people are still going to be able to vote. So I don't know how we can make this distinction and try to assign some kind of moral superiority based off of one classification of crimes over the other when it comes to the basic unit of democracy, which is the right to vote, the most fundamental right that we have.
There was an interesting, I just bring this up because I thought it was an interesting question, and I wonder what you think about this, Brenton. There was a story in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel yesterday that looked at jury screening at a firearm silencer possession trial, and one member of the 28-person panel had an unusual reply. I'm reading from the article to the judge's question. Has anyone ever been convicted of a crime? The juror raised his hand and asked if that included a case of not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. The juror had killed his wife and children 27 years ago, stabbing each of them more than 20 times. And here he winds up in the potential juror pool. I guess it's an article that gives you pause. What do you think about a case like that? If I would imagine, I'm wondering what the case was, that in most states, if you can vote, then that's how they get your name for a jury pool. So you would be eligible to be on a jury if you're if you have been involved in that kind of crime. Should you be on a jury? There are other questions that come to mind, right?
Yeah, well, in Florida, that, I mean, that's one state where having a felony conviction does bar you from serving on the jury. You know, I mean, it's just it's another disenfranchising factor. And you know, and it's another thing that takes you, that blocks entrance to, you know, being able to participate in democracy. And this really matters, right? Like, when we look at the Dunn-Jordan Davis case, right, like the verdict that was delivered on that was delivered by a jury of Dunn's peers. And there have been a lot of complaints that there was not enough racial analysis into why Dunn killed Jordan Davis.
Right.
But every time that you shrink the jury pool based off of felony disenfranchisement, what you're doing is you're taking out people who potentially could have served on that jury, people of color who would have understood the racial dynamics and might have had no problem at all convicting Dunn for killing Jordan Davis.
Mm. And we're talking about that case, that appalling case, tomorrow during our 1 o'clock hour, the Jordan Davis case. Let's go next to, thanks, John, very much for your call. Daniel is next in Madison. We'll have time for a couple more calls. You could get through if you want to call now, 800-486-8655. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
All right, Daniel, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I mean, here I think the argument we're making at this current point is the wrong argument. I'm not saying pro or against what you guys are saying. The problem is American was found on taxation with representation, and this is the argument we should make. It doesn't matter if we don't like these people. It doesn't matter if these people aren't the kind of people that we find savory or we want to be part of. The fact is they all pay taxes. Without them being able to vote, it's taxation without representation, and that's the ultimate founding of the United States.
Britain.
Absolutely. I mean, people, even while they're incarcerated, they are adding to the tax revenue of a state based off of their labor, based off of whatever contracts exist with private prison companies. And, you know, to bring a quick point up, there was an article or research that came out just today that said private prisons incarcerate people of color at a larger rate than public prisons. So we're privatizing racial disparities right now. All of these people are they're money earners for the state, for the nation. They all need to be represented and be able to vote.
Thanks so much, Daniel. Mark is our last caller in Superior. Hi, Mark.
Yes, thank you for this program. I agree with your guest. I'm just wondering what he would say, his opponents, what argument do they make to say that society benefits from preventing people to vote? I don't see the argument that can be made for that.
Well, I think you've heard from some callers that you should just forfeit your right if you've committed a terrible act. You know, think of the victim. That's part of your punishment.
I see that the punitive part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But what argument could be made that society as a whole benefits from preventing people to vote?
Brenton, is there one?
I don't think that there is an argument. If I heard him right, I don't think that there is an argument out there made about society benefiting from the disenfranchisement of anybody. This is a completely punitive measure. It does not comport with any restorative or progressive understanding of justice, no matter what your definition is. And again, I mean, even if you look at it from an economic point of view, taking people out of society, you're taking away workers, you're taking away potential teachers, garbage workers, janitors, your future mayors. I mean, it's a deficit.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Brenton, thank you so much for being with us. Please join us again. It was a fascinating conversation. Brenton Mock, he is a Washington, D.C.-based journalist. He's a reporting fellow for ColorLines.com. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour, to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have another hour coming up following the news from NPR.